welcome back to another exciting episode of the Captain America Minute, where we examine the 2011 Joe Johnston-directed feature, Captain America, the First Avenger, at the rate of 1 minute of screen time per episode. I'm one of your hosts just a few miles from Kitty Hawk, North Carolina. This is Jim O'Kane of TVDads.com.
And while our second co-host, Hal Bryan, is away on assignment, I'm your third co-host, Brian Fees, a graphic novelist and lifelong Avengers comic book reader.
And we are 101 minutes into this adventure as we're having a fight in the bomber. Brian, why don't you pick up where Hal usually does this and let us know what's going on in minute 101.
It is action-packed, and I think we're going to miss Hal because we're going to talk about planes and such today. But aboard the airborne Valkyrie, Steve Rogers clambers over the massive tires of the landing gear, emerging onto a catwalk. He freezes, spotting rows of sleek flying bombs, each with a cockpit and labeled with city names, Chicago, Boston. His eyes lock on the nearest one, marked New York, his face tightening with horror at the scale of the Red Skull's planned attack. A group of Hydra pilots advances down the catwalk. Steve leaps, kicking one off the ledge, the man plummeting with a scream. The others spin at the noise. The closest pilot yanks a knife from his boot and lunges. Steve blocks the attack, then kicks the next pilot in line. Seizing the knife, he hurls it, striking a third pilot between the shoulders. The man collapses against the railing. Steve grapples with the knife-wielding pilot, noticing another climbing into the Chicago bomb. Steve darts to a control panel and hits a release switch. The bomb drops, the pilot still outside the cockpit, falling to his death with it. Steve wrestles the first pilot, finally hoisting him up and tossing him through the open bomb bay. The man screams, fading into the distance. Meanwhile, another pilot slips into the New York bomb, sealing the canopy as the craft hums to life.
This is what you go to the movies for. This is definitely pure action pack. Or this is actually what you read comic books for. I mean, you can see every one of these scenes laid out like it's a storyboard.
Absolutely.
And I would buy this comic.
Well, that was one of my notes on this minute is Joe Johnston and crew give us a really good sense of place here. You know, we know where everybody is. We know where they're coming from. I loved the scene, how the minute opens with Cap kind of still on the landing gear tire as it's pulled up into the fuselage, because so often, and I think of the movie Catch Me If You Can, where Leonardo DiCaprio escapes custody by prying apart an airplane toilet and slipping through the hole in the airplane toilet and somehow emerging from the wheel well to scamper away as the plane's taxiing in. It so often the whole area underneath a plane is treated as a black hole. People get on the tire and somehow they're in the, you know, they're in the passenger compartment or vice versa. And this gives a very clear, I understand how Steve got aboard this plane. He got on the tire. The tire's pulled up in the fuselage. It's right there. We see it. There's people around him. Very clear. And then the fight is on this series of catwalks. But again, very clear action of who's where, how they got there, who's kicking whom where, who's falling off of what. I think it's nicely staged.
Yeah, and it's also, it seems like this could really happen. I mean, the way those two pilots fall away from the plane, that looks like they went into the airstream and whoosh, they're gone. I love the physics of it all. You can feel every punch. You can feel how, you know, Cap is blocking all these kicks and hits and tossing the knife. You kind of feel it between your shoulders when he hits them.
You do. Resounding thunk.
Yes.
Well,
yes.
Your thought on the pilots being swept away in the air current is right on. It's another note I had because I recalled when we did an earlier episode in which Cap parachuted out of Howard Stark's plane. Our paratrooper expert friend Mike Harkins criticized it because in that shot, we see Cap basically falling straight down from the plane. Peggy's able to watch his descent for a while. And he said, no, that he would hit the air and he'd be swept backwards from the plane's point of view. And that's exactly what happens to these two goons in this one is they're out the door and whoosh, they're backwards.
Yeah, they are gone like used gum wrappers. It's just out and gone. I also like the lighting seems very natural. Like the only light that we're getting is from those open, well, I guess the open wheel, the open wheel wells, but also the bomb bay doors where these flying bombs are going to be coming out of. So everybody's lit from underneath, which looks very sinister, but a beautiful beautiful use of lighting in frame, which is kind of that's a noir feature that only turned up in like the late 30s or 40s of how to light a scene. Every light source is in view in this particular scene. I like the
I
way,
had, yeah.
yeah, I like the way, like, for example, there's lights shining over where the pilots are supposed to enter their individual bomb cockpits. They have that one light shining, a little well light that's shining on the word New York, for example. It just gives a nice, and it's also a low temperature light. That's probably like a 32. I don't want to mean to get too technical, but it's a 3200 K lighting that's happening on that New York against the beautiful 5400 of the blue sky below them. So it just really it sets you it you get an intimacy for the tightness of this little catwalks, but you also see the great blue yonder out the bottom of the plane.
Yeah, and you're right. It is a different temperature, different shade of blue, outdoors versus indoors. It's a great observation. I hadn't really noticed the direction of the light, but you're absolutely right. It's very important. It's all coming from below and elsewhere. We're in a dark part of the plane. What I noted about the light is the orange and blue is just nuts in this minute. And I've talked about the orange and blue before, about how so many commercials, so many movies really play with the orange blue complementary color palette. I use the word complementary because they're on opposite sides of the color wheel. And you get the warmth of the orange, the cold of the blue. It's a terrific contrast. And in addition to the blue lighting you mentioned, there's sort of this diffuse orange lighting. It looks like, coming from fixtures in distant walls far away. It's coming through the doorway the hydropilots enter through. You see it in what look like, frankly, fluorescent fixtures in the distance. But it's orange and blue, orange and blue, and orange blue, and it's a beautiful palette. And people use it because it works, and it works like gangbusters in this minute.
Oh yeah. Your eye is drawn everywhere to the light and to the action, and so many, perfect editing on this. I know this was storyboard. Joe Johnson doesn't fool around with guessing on pre-production, but every shot is serving a purpose. There's nothing extraneous. We're seeing where everybody is on the plane, where his targets are, who's fighting whom. And what happens to the pilots as they, two of them meet their bitter end.
I'm very surprised we didn't get a Wilhelm scream out of this minute, but we already had one, so it would probably be overkill. Perfect time for a Wilhelm.
I mean, there's enough good natured, maybe even original screams. I'm sure they're somewhere else in the Warner Library of audio effects. It is beautiful, the physicality of it all. I love that last scene where Cap picks up the pilot and just chucks him straight. It was like nothing but net when he throws that last pilot through the open bombay door. Or yeah, I guess it is a bombay door. It's a bomb that flies.
I agree. That caught my eye as well, because at first it seemed to me that Cap was having a little too much trouble dispatching these goons. Like, they were putting up a little too good a fight, and then he just gets sick of this guy and he just picks him up and chucks him out the door. And it was wonderful. It's a good reminder to the viewer of just how strong Captain America is.
Yeah, and he doesn't have time for this kind of shenanigans. It's like, let's get this fight over
Exactly.
with.
Just get out of my way. Whew, it's almost like Indy shooting the swordsman, you know?
Yeah, exactly. The other thing, the thing that I've been thinking about in watching this minute as a whole is those bombs have the words New York and Boston and Chicago on them, as though, don't drop this one on Chicago. This is a Boston bomb. But it doesn't need to be there, but it tells the story without somebody narrating it. It's like, oh, these bombs are all meant for the major cities of America.
Sure. Well, and it calls back to, I'm sure, the old World War II pictures we've always seen of American bombs, for example, with writing on the side of them, Howdy Adolf and Hello Tokyo and that kind of thing. It recalls that to me.
And one thing that it reminds me of, that I bring this up frequently in other conversations, when most American kids were growing up, they were always told, some teacher told them or their parents told them that the town that they lived in was, marked as a bomb site number one for the Soviet Union was going to take over because whatever your town was famous for, the Ruskies needed to destroy it. And Brian, I know you grew up, in South Dakota, and South Dakota is kind of an obvious target. A
We've had this
military,
conversation before. I grew up in Rapid City, South Dakota, which is very close to Ellsworth Air Force Base. So I think we legitimately would have been an early target.
and they wanted to get rid of Mount Rushmore too. So you're in trouble. I grew up in Elizabeth, New Jersey, across the river from New York City. So New York City, we'd either get hit by the collateral damage of blowing up Manhattan, or the one that the nuns used to tell me was that the Bayway Refinery, which was the largest refinery on the East Coast, was definitely a target because if you knocked out the Bayway Refinery, nobody on the East Coast would have gasoline. So that was always a reason.
Yep, you're right. And it's funny. Everybody thinks their little town is special in that way. There's something here that the commies have just got to take out quick.
I used to I dated a girl from Odessa, Texas, and I had asked I had brought I've been talking about this thing for years, and I asked her what were the Soviets trying to go after her town, and I thought she'd be saying, well, it's the oil fields, and they'd be destroying the oil fields, but she said, no, it's where they built the Norden bomb site. And I didn't have the heart to tell her that they don't use the Norden bomb site hasn't been used since World War II, so sorry. But anyway, it was her story, and let her tell it.
We'll put a nuke on that factory. Which is the only place you can get a bomb site. Oh my gosh.
Wow. Well, hopefully they don't aim at Kitty Hawk, but I really don't know what's going on here in the Outer Banks that would warrant an atom bomb. But I'm sure there's some. Well, we're not too far from Camp Lejeune, so it would knock out
There
the
you go.
Marine base.
I think they got a gripe against the Wright brothers mostly.
Jerry,
I'd love to
go ahead.
talk about how beautiful these piloted bombs are designed. And again, this is why I wish we had Hal on the minute because they got propel not propellers. Maybe that's the wrong word. I'm wondering if they're autogyros or if they're propelled instruments.
Yeah, they're like
I don't know
they're,
what they are.
it's almost like a vertical. It's kind of like the same version of what we saw in Red Skull's, his little getaway
Well,
rocket,
that's true. They might be smaller versions of that same technology.
and it might be like a. I'm thinking like a horizontal, or autogyro that kind of screws its way into the air. Maybe it turns into a bomb, and it slowly you can aim it as it's falling out of the sky. They might
But
not
they
have
are
to have,
manned.
yeah, and you'd think they wouldn't have to have too much of a range, unless all they had to do is get you within maybe 1,000 miles of your target. I mean, New York, Boston, and Chicago, the ones that we saw are easily within 1,500 miles of a flight. So maybe if you just got it as far as Pittsburgh and they unleash the fury, they could get all three towns. I also
Kind
noticed that
of took it that way, yeah.
it's also all East Coast, but maybe he's got a whole maybe on the other wing there's the West Coast ones that he's saving for later.
I did kind of take it that way, that the big flying wing, the Valkyrie, was just a ferry, more or less, for this fleet of little bombs that would, all fall out somewhere over West Virginia and all go their separate ways.
It's I was thinking it's a lot like the dirigible, the Shenandoah, which had a whole little fleet of biplanes, and this is just the same idea writ large. I don't think they would have much of I mean they do. We'll save that for another minute about its what kind of capabilities it has for shooting and stuff. But it really doesn't need that much in the way of armament. I would assume that this is it has enough armament to knock off the pursuing fighters that are trying to knock it out of the sky, which is something that the Red Skull might have picked up from the V1. When the buzz bombs were first introduced, although that's a year later. This is supposed to be the end of 1943, and 1944 is when the buzz bombs were introduced to attack London. The V1s, the Vengeance Weapon One, was a ramjet propelled cruise missile, basically it was the first cruise missile, and RAF pilots found out that they could knock them out of the sky if they came up next to them. They weren't faster than Spitfires, and the Spitfires could actually just bump them and knock them off course. So maybe he decided to put in some defensive thinking ahead, that if any fighter planes came up to attack him, they'd at least have some kind of a defense mechanism.
That makes sense. We don't see them do that, but it'd be sure easy to put a little blue ray gun on them and shooting things out of the sky. That makes good sense. But I agree. They more or less, I just can't get over the fact that these things are manned. I mean, it's a kamikaze mission. It's got to be a suicide bomb situation.
And these guys seem to be a lot more fanatical than even the SS. So, I don't know where he's finding them, or maybe he's got them drugged or things that they're doing it for the greater glory of Hydra. Hydras always seem a little bit more maniacal, at least in the comic books. They're more maniacal than the Nazis. So.
Yes. Well, don't underestimate the power of true believership.
That's true. Yeah.
I think these guys believe in their cause and they're willing to die for it. I think it's just that simple.
Yeah, but looking at all of this, what is their end game? If you're going to be destroying all these cities in America, what's going to be left? I mean, what is Red Skull's end game? I've never been able to figure that out. He wants power, but I think he's just going to wind up with
Rule
this. Yeah,
the world.
yeah.
Whatever,
Hold.
whatever's left of the rubble, he'll be
Yeah.
bouncing the rubble.
The king of ashes and cinders. Yeah, I guess it doesn't really matter. He knows what he wants, and he's got that. He'll work the end game out later.
Well, I'm still talking about the aircraft. I'm sorry to interrupt. I just
No.
want to one note. I love the sound design on this because as the one bomb flies away that's Cap releases, you hear its propeller going. Off
Yes.
into the distance, and it's so evocative, and it really, if you hadn't noticed the thing had a propeller, that sound cues you into it. Sort of describes how the whole thing works. It gives you the feel of, okay, there's a whooshing thing that it's going away, but it's out of control. It's tumbling into space. I just love that woof woof woof. That woof does so much work in this minute in the movie.
Yeah, that definitely. And it's I would think that you wouldn't be able to hear much with the doors open, but
Oh
it's
no.
but you can still hear the smacking and booming and stuff like that. So it's cinematic, but it gives you that realism, that feel. Even the sounds of the doors opening and like the clamps unlocking, all those little bits make these flats, they're basically made out of plywood and paper mache, but it gives you this the heft, the feel of that these are aluminum girders with magnesium clamps holding everything down. It is amazing what happens when even when you turn the sound off, the look of it still feels verisimilitude, that's the word. Yes.
Verisimilitudinous.
Yes.
Yeah, well, I have long maintained. I mean, my only insight into filmmaking, which you'll consider puerile, is that sound design is probably more than 50% of the audience experience, and they have no consciousness of it. I mean, sound is so important of establishing time and place and mood and action. And I'm not even talking about music. I'm just talking about clanging and banging and whooshing and gosh, it's just so well done in this minute.
Yeah, I mean, all you have to do if you want to convince somebody of sound is watch Obi-Wan battle Darth Vader in Star Wars with the sound off, and it just looks
Yeah.
like two guys banging sticks together, which is basically what they were
It
doing.
is, yeah. Yeah.
But we identify so much sounds in our lives. We identify so much with particular things, and it's something that, I mean, every one of your senses has a memory attached to it. And you can like it's probably, I would say, third in what your memory can do with it. Smells, I would say, is well, actually, smells, I would say, is second. First is taste. Even you can taste things you've never tasted before. Like imagine licking a concrete sidewalk. You can feel that in your mouth, even if you've never licked concrete before. But your brain has so much attached to the sensual nature of things. I think sound also, if you hear it, you'll hear a sound like you might hear an ice cream truck bells, and it'll throw you back to being 5 years old and running down the street with a quarter or something like that. It's amazing how much the sound makes you brings you into the universe that you're watching.
Absolutely. I agree completely.
A lot of diffusion in this particular, I think I noticed that a lot in all the Hydra scenes. You were talking about just the blues and the oranges, but I noticed that there's an awful lot of diffusion in here. It's almost like it's a foggy day. But we've seen that in previous scenes. We've seen it in Red Skull's office. We've also seen it in the prison at the Hydra factory. What it does is it allows the blue to scatter more. But it's interesting that I think it also represents evil. I think the note that we're getting from
Nice.
this is fog is evil, because
Nice.
we don't see any fog at like the World of Tomorrow that we were visiting with Cap at the, with Steve at the beginning of the movie.
Man, I think you just earned your pay for the day. That's a great insight. And you know, I'm scrubbing back and forth through the minute and note that when they open the bomb bay doors, it gets a lot foggier. I think we're supposed to interpret that as clouds coming in the door almost. I mean, there's movement and action in this haze that's swooshing through the cockpit in a way it probably wouldn't in real life or the bomb bay. It gets a lot foggier the last 10 seconds of this minute.
I'm almost certain that the wheels at the very beginning of this scene, which I love those wheels, the giant oversized wheels, I'm pretty convinced that it's a VFX. It's visual effect. It's not a real size tire. He's walking along a blue screen in the background, and or in the other part, there's a background where he's just they've taken his background and put in a model of tires. But those gigantic tires spinning gives you just a sense of how big this ship is. I just love the. I mean, that's almost like a Batman type of thing with, giant anything.
A giant penny, yeah.
It's just
Well, a giant typewriter. Well, it gives a sense of scale because we've seen that wheel before. We all know what a wheel looks like. I don't know what the inside of an evil flying wing looks like, but I know what a tire looks like. And you're right, it gives the whole scene a nice sense of scale. It's the first thing we see is Cap pushing this wheel or getting off this wheel. I agree with you. It's probably an effect, but doesn't matter, does it?
No, it's, I mean, I in watching this, I can't, which is wonderful, I can't tell which parts are visual, which parts are visual effects and which parts are, it's a set full of bombs. I don't think any of
Yeah.
those were constructed, except maybe the hero ones that he's jumping on. And
I bet you're right.
they might only be parts of the bombs.
I bet what we're looking at here are real catwalks with a bunch of green screen behind them.
Yeah. Which is
Yeah.
just simply amazing. I mean, I know it's common. I mean, this movie is, at the time we're recording this, is 15 years old, but it still doesn't fail to impress.
Yeah. Well, what's interesting to me about VFX too is how they age and how they don't age. If you watch the original Jurassic Park, it's still solid.
Oh,
And
yeah.
it's an old movie in VFX terms. But there's nothing wrong with the original Jurassic Park, and it's because the effects are done with skill and taste and thoughtfulness in a way maybe they aren't in other movies that have aged poorly. And this has the same kind of feel to me. I think this scene and most of the effects in Captain America, especially as we've talked before about the Skinny Steve effects, they're going to last forever. They're going to look great forever.
I think so. I mean, it there, like you said, there's a certain artistry that you can, and it's funny how now it is unforgivable to have subpar special effects, and we see pushbacks on that, like the one I think of is the last season of Game of Thrones, where they couldn't figure out how to do the special effects for the White Walkers, so they just fought them at night and made it all dark. And it's just like, that was a cheap cop out. So it's like either go big or go home, I think is what I'm trying to say about
Well,
those kind of
dark does
effects.
hide a lot of sins, and this is a pretty dark scene as well. But the dark hard darkness hides wires, it hides all kinds of things. But as I recall, I think that's why in the original Chris Reeves Superman movie, his first flying scene takes place at night because you could just hide a lot of sins with night.
Oh, for sure. Wow. Well, this has been an intriguing minute. Sorry we don't have Hal with us. Hopefully he will be back from assignment soon. But I think we've pieced this minute together okay without our fearless leader
Well, we
of
missed him, but
aircraft stuff.
it's a good minute that gave us a lot to work with.
Yeah, definitely. Wow. And, you know, if you would like to join the conversation that we've been having, we're always available over at Camp Lehigh, the Captain America Minute listeners base on Facebook. And if you do like our show, don't forget to subscribe and leave a like at the podcast streaming service where you found this particular episode. Also, please check out our great big website, capminute.com, for the latest about our podcast topics and guests. And be sure to join us here next time on the Captain America Minute.
I can do this all day.